Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the swallowed whole to my total asshole, it's Dan. How are you doing this evening, Dan?
Oh, well, pretty good, pretty good. How are you doing? I'm not going to say what I was going to say, so.
Yeah, let's not. That was one of those, I can't come up with something for the intro until like 3 minutes before the intro. And it's like, all right, whatever. Just let's move on. So we are here to talk about the latest episode of Hannibal, as per always. I don't know if there's anything we wanted to chat about beforehand. There is one little thing for folks on our Facebook page to keep an eye out for. Do we use the phrase that I cheated on you for a podcast? Is that appropriate?
Yeah.
Actually did recorded a podcast with our friend Susan from the Geek Girl Soup podcast that will be released later this week from what I'm told. We actually focused on a bunch of different comedy series. Now, the reason why I didn't do it on our podcast isn't because we have drama in our title, because we've certainly talked about comedies like Parks and Recreation and stuff before. It's just you've actually never seen any of the shows. And on the flip side, on Susan's podcast, her most frequent co-host, Kelly, generally speaking, isn't very predisposed to watch most TV comedies. I mean, she's watched a few, but for the most part, she tends not to like comedies very much. So both me and Susan were like, hey, both of our co-hosts either haven't seen these and or don't want to see them, so let's do a podcast together. So we knocked that one out. And the big joke is after, you know, an hour and a half later, we finished. And I'm like, wait, remember how we just wanted to do it about three or four? We forgot one of them, but it was too late. Yeah, but hopefully that'll be a worthwhile listen later this week.
Yeah, whatever. I can live with it. You know, it fits into our relationship here with me being the producer. You know, you cheat on me. I do all the work. It's a typical relationship for me. So. Yeah, I like watching comedies too, but I really don't take the time to do it. So I've, in fact, since Parks and Rec ended, I've watched like 8 episodes of a Canadian sitcom from like 10 years ago. This that I've been watching, so I can get the disc back to one of my friends. So, yeah.
Well, with that all said, I guess we should probably switch gears and get to why we're here tonight. And again, that's to talk about Hannibal. Right off the bat, we should address the title of the episode, which is kind of amusing. Last week's title, folks may recall, was And the Woman Clothed with the Sun, which is the second part of the William Blake title for his painting and poem, whatever, The Great Red Dragon and the Woman Clothed with the Sun. This week's title is And the Woman Clothed in the Sun. So, I don't know if I can recall ever seeing anything quite like that before. You know, I don't think half measures and full measures from Breaking Bad quite count. So, I was like, wait. It's one of those things that if you looked at it quickly, you'd think it was just like a weirdly edited post on a Facebook page. Where, wait, what's the difference here? Oh, they changed with the to end. But it was an interesting little choice that they were. So let's get to the beginning of the episode. One of the things I enjoyed about this episode is the fact that we got to focus more on Francis Dolarhyde, because I think he's kind of a fascinating character. And the first thing we see is, I'm going to say he's sounding out syllables in the mirror, you know, like he's holding his throat and everything. It's similar to speech therapy exercises. So I think he was kind of trying to prepare himself to try to be as eloquent as possible, which kind of makes sense once we realize what happens over the next few minutes. You kind of get to see just how clever and how smart this guy really is. Because I don't know if folks realized he had such a brain before. They figured, you know, he's just kind of crazy. But, you know, we see him switching the license plate on what I call his rapey van. Come on, it looks like the van a serial rapist would have. You know, no windows on the sides or anything. And we're trying to figure out what it is he's doing, because he looks like he breaks into someone's house. He's fiddling with what looks like the phone lines. Then we finally realize what he's doing. He's doing what I kind of made fun of at the very end of last week's episode. He's finding a way to call Lecter in the state hospital and how he can get away with it. And that made me go, that's very smart. And I was surprised by this whole thing, only because this, as best as I can recall, did not happen in the book. Because in the book, he mailed him a letter. So they had to go a totally different route here.
Yeah, it worked. That worked pretty well. But, they probably didn't have to explain what they were doing. But the fact that they did it, just like you said, makes them seem that much more intelligent, because, that is pretty, pretty smart.
Yeah, I think it's A, to show his intelligence, and that way when we see him doing anything that requires a lot of planning, a lot more thought than just, here's a family, here's where they live, I'm going to watch them for a while and kill them. We've already seen the groundwork for that. The other reason is we get to have that conversation with Lecter again, except we get to see it go on further, which was probably one of the best things about this episode. And I really liked this episode. I'll tell you right now, I liked it. First of all, but they did one thing that was interesting. When we were watching last week, all we really saw was Dalryd saying his whole little spiel about how he's been reading up on Lecter and how I'm sure he wouldn't turn me in even if you knew who I was. But Lecter doesn't say very much to him except for, tell me what you're becoming. There's an additional line here, which wasn't in last week's episode, even though it's part of the same chunk of conversation, because we're watching it from Francis Dalryd's perspective, so we're seeing him speak, and then we hear Lecter say early on in the conversation, what particular body you currently occupy is trivial, and we didn't see him say that or hear him say that last week, so which I'm fine with. It's, I'll just chalk it up to creative editing, but I was confused by that, and I actually had to go back and watch the previous episode. And because it was on demand, I couldn't fast forward any freaking commercials, so I had to play the episode, just go in the other room, do something else for it, then go back in and like, okay, he never said that last week, because it struck me as odd, because we get lines he says later in the conversation. What I adored about this is that they came up with a way, and kudos to Brian Fuller, the creator, his co-writer, I think his name is Don Mancini, the director, everyone involved, that they came up with a way to have these two characters be face-to-face, which has never happened in any other version of this story before. But they came up with it, and it was great. I was so thrilled with the scene. I can't tell you how happy the scene made me. I was like, it was like Christmas morning for me watching that scene. Anyway, but back to the details of the scene, but we really get into the conversation. I love him talking to Lecter about how he feels he's probably gotten unfair reviews from the press, which I love that, how Lecter's like, a misunderstood movie or something like that. And of course, they get to the whole point of him not appreciating the fact that he's called a tooth fairy, which I believe is going to play a bigger part later in the season. And there is that one great little line or couple lines from Lecter after hearing Dalryd speak so much. He says that your speech is bent and pruned by disabilities, real and imagined, but your words are startling. So the thing about this scene, and I'm going to ask you about this now. We've seen Hannibal Lecter encounter at least a few other killers or nutcases or whatever over the course of the first 2.5 seasons of this show. And I think pretty much every time, I've always gotten the impression that Hannibal Lecter has thought himself to be considerably better and more evolved, etc., than whoever it is he's speaking to. He's always kind of has a certain
condescending attachment, kind of, and a little bit,
but he kind of looks down on them. Also, right. You're not as good as I am, and just to prove the point, I think we've seen him in the first couple seasons. He'll actually mimic the way they've killed someone, but take it to another level. So he's like does a better job of it than they do, I guess. This is one of the first times I can recall where it almost felt, although it's the young and the old, so to speak, even though I don't think there's that much difference in their age, quite frankly, I felt there was more of a mutual respect between them, if that makes any sense, more so than I saw him with all the other killers he's encountered. Is that just my own misperception?
I couldn't say misperception, but I kind of got more of the impression that he was just, more like patronizing him and just trying to suck up to him just so he could manipulate him that much easier.
Okay. That would make, make sense for the story, but.
Well, it could, this way he was acting just kind of came off as inauthentic. So, maybe you are right. And, he is behaving in a way that's different than what we've seen, which is why it doesn't feel authentic to me. Or he's just, genuinely just being inauthentic because he's just being, an ass and screwing with him.
Yeah, and it's also hard to tell with a character like Lecter because, he's someone whose words often seem to be led by multiple motivations. And whether it's for something as callous as just this is going to entertain him to something far more diabolical, which we can imagine he probably does have diabolical thoughts or plans to try to use Dalaride. But my feeling is with this character, it doesn't require that much of a push.
Right.
So because I think with Lecter and the people he's dealt with before, because Lecter, a lot of it is about controlling people, manipulating people. That's his thing. Other than eating people, that's his other thing. He manipulates him or he eats him, one or the other. Like Will Graham. And obviously, there is going to be some sort of manipulation involved here, but I don't know how much of a push is really needed. Because I think the things that we can anticipate Dalaride may or may not do, for the most part, he probably would have done it of his own accord anyway. I think Lecter might just give him a little bit of a push. But I don't know, because like this moment and a bigger one later on in the episode, they are going a little bit away from the text on occasionally, which excites me actually, because I can't be totally sure of what they're going to do, which I enjoy. The other thing I really loved about this, the scene, was it wasn't simply a matter of, we're getting surreal and we're getting into the memory palace or anything like that. Because I felt we were also seeing this more from Dalaride's perspective because of his own kind of a split personality situation he has going on. So the fact that he actually walks around and he's watching himself talk to Lecter was really something I thought was kind of striking. And then it ends with that moment where Dalaride actually becomes the dragon in front of Hannibal Lecter.
Although, that was sweet.
It was sweet, but I had to say, I love the effect of it, but it also reminded me of like every other heavy metal album cover from the 80s. It's like, yeah, wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm sure somewhere in the country, Meatloaf was just like, fuck yeah.
And speaking of that phrase you just said, fuck yeah, I believe one or both of us probably said that in the next scene when we saw Bedelia.
Oh, yeah, and I'll be the first to say it. I mean, We were kind of dumb for not realizing that she was definitely going to be back. I mean, just based on the fact that we've already seen Zachary Quinto as a brief scene as a corpse. I mean, we should have remembered that was actually probably going to come back around. They weren't just doing that.
It would have been really weird to have Zachary Quinto show up, for basically 65 seconds when not know what the hell is going on. So we get to see Bedelia. And we see that she's speaking, it was unclear if it was an auditorium, if it was a class or a seminar, or people paying to see her speak now, perhaps, you know, because of what she went through. But she's basically talking about how she fell under Lecter's spell, which we all know is total bullshit.
I also just watched the first episode of series 2, which kind of starts with Will lecturing a group of Quantico students or something like that. So I kind of got the impression she was doing the same thing, just speaking to a group of agents or somebody at some college there or something.
It could have been. What would have been interesting is if you'd watched the two episodes back to back, or within minutes of each other, to see if the space she's occupying looks the same or not. Because if it's the same, because that would have been the ideal thing for them to do, have her speaking in the very same room that Will was giving his lecture at the very beginning of the series. That would have been actually excellent. So
yeah, I'll try to look it up by next week if I have time,
I would send a tweet to Brian Fuller to ask him, but much like all my other tweets, it'll be ignored. So, Will shows up there, and afterwards we get this nice little conversation between the two of them, and Will reels off a couple good lines, especially when referring to the fact of her being swallowed up by the beast, and he says, "Yeah, you didn't lose yourself, Bedelia. You just crawled so far up his ass you couldn't be bothered." And I went, wow, did he just say what I think he said? But then I thought she did a nice counter punch when he refers to her as the Bride of Frankenstein. And she says, "Well, we both were." It's like, oh, hey, the killer husband, the murder husband thing that Freddie Lowndes said. Here we go again. It's interesting because, and it plays into what we saw for the first part of the season. But there always seems to be this weird sort of, I don't know how else to refer to it, kind of like a jealousy between them. It seems that way, and I think it's there deliberately. I don't think it's an accident. I don't think I'm just reading into it. It's, especially when you read any comments from the creator, like, oh yeah, this is clearly what they're doing. He's really having fun playing with the ideas of sexuality and whatever here.
Yeah, and the looks on Will's face when he's just sitting there listening to her, like, tell her bullshit too. They're pretty priceless.
Oh yeah, it took us back to when they were in Italy. And one of the few scenes I think we felt. I mean, while we thought a lot of scenes were good, one of the very few scenes I think we thought were fun was Bedelia being in a somewhat drug-addled state, still being able to take on both Will and Jack, and essentially have the upper hand no matter what they say. So it did definitely remind me of that to a certain extent. Well, then we switch gears, and did I say that already? This podcast, I apologize for being repetitive, but we zip over to Francis Dolarhyde, and he's with Rita, and he wants to take her someplace, wants to show her something, and we know that they're going to the zoo, but she's a little confused by why they're going there. And we find out that he's actually gotten permission, that they're fixing a tooth on one of the tigers there. So they've, pretty much they've drugged it. They've given it the Bill Cosby treatment, I guess. And do I have to make a Bill Cosby joke in every podcast now? It's kind of mandatory now. I was going to do an impression, but I stopped myself. Okay. And this whole scene where he brings Rita in and her reaction and her touching the tiger and how the profound effect it has on her. I gotta say, if it wasn't being done by one of the sick serial killers in all of popular fiction, it would be a really romantic scene. The part I really liked during that scene was when Rita's hands move towards the tiger's mouth, which is like where the injured tooth is, whatever, and we see Francis react to it and covering his own mouth, because it's almost the parallel there. I found that very powerful, and I thought I've seen both movie versions of this scene now. because they did this back in the original, and then they did it again with, you know, fantastic actress Ralph Fiennes and Emily Watson.
What?
Is that her name?
Yep.
In the Brett Ratner version. I keep forgetting she was in it. It's like, my God, look at that cast. How did you screw that up? Anyway, I actually thought they did a better job here. I thought this actually was more effective than those two previous versions, which is saying something.
Oh yeah, it was really solid. The music was really good, and I liked the way they kind of like oversaturated the fur on the tiger as he was kind of describing it, you know, in such a, you know, glowing, I guess, terms, whatever. But just the way they did it, just a really nice touch, and they pulled it off well. So the effects team on the show is just, I mean, they know what they're doing. So whatever they do next, hopefully it's good.
It's hard to say that something using color can be both saturated and subtle at the same time, but I thought they accomplished it there, because exactly what you just said, echoing what his description of the color to her, and we see the orange is so intense. It's I can use the word literally correctly here. It's literally radiating off the tiger's body. So it's, yeah, really something. So they go back to his place. I was going to talk about how elegant and eloquent he is. I think she even refers to him that way, as what he has done. Of course, I just did it in a very inelegant and inarticulate way. But I like the fact that she starts talking to him about having discussed him with other people. And you can see he starts to go into his self-conscious mode. And he tends to withdraw. But here's what I thought was interesting. We find out that his coworkers find him mysterious, and while they know he's sensitive about his face, they don't think he should be. I thought that was kind of an interesting little tweak there. And again, I don't remember if it's in the book or not. I didn't read every freaking page over again. But I like the idea that his coworkers actually think well of him. You know, I mean, yeah, he's a little mysterious, but I like the fact that they think, hey, you know, he's obviously a little self-conscious about the thing on his mouth, but yeah, it's not that big a deal. You know, I kind of like that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that was a nice touch, and I think it'll, you know, it'll kind of like, you know, maybe make the character, you know, a little bit more sympathetic by just having it be not that much more tragic. Just like, you know, he really has no reason to be doing this.
Right, exactly. Because it's the reversal of the usual, oh, you're a monster and people shrink back from you and whatever, or people find you gross or disgusting or creepy. It's like, no, he's got a little thing on his lip. It's not that big a deal. So then they're on the couch and, okay, I'm guessing what happens looked like a blowjob to me. I wasn't clear when she got up. Usually I think that means you're done, but the way he left her up to go to the other room to do more, I'm thinking, he's not 16 years old. Maybe she didn't finish. Maybe I spent too much time thinking about it. I don't know. I did spend too much time thinking about it. But we get a sex scene. And what I liked about the tail end of this, that pun's not really intended, and it just occurred to me now, not in my notes, that early in the episode we see Francis realized as the Great Red Dragon, and now we see Reba as the woman clothed in the sun, as though those two pieces should go together and form the painting in question. It's really a striking, beautiful image of her in this glorious sunlit outfit, but I like that I didn't realize until just now that it's actually a callback to that in the episode.
Yeah, I was just happy it wasn't annoying like the Dr. Bloom Margot one several episodes past. So pretty much as long as they don't stink it up like that, they can fuck the whole episode. I don't care.
Oh, you didn't want a kaleidoscope effect? You didn't want the image being plastered like 1,000 times on the screen. Blah, 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 blah. I discovered if you watch that scene with Alana and Margot from that episode from a few episodes ago, but you put on the music from the Benny Hill show, the Yakety Sax thing, It's amazing. It works perfectly. If they had done that, that would have been my favorite scene in the show. Anyway, later on, you know, while she's sleeping, we see him running his hand, her hand over his face, which I thought was kind of a sweet move before snuggling closer. By the way, it feels really weird for me to refer to anything with Frances Dahlhardt as being either sweet or snuggly. It's just, it shouldn't be used, but I am. But when he wakes up again, she's not there, and he panics. And I like that they use this music. It's really very reminiscent of some of the musical pieces used in The Shining, which I don't know if you're aware of this or not, because I know you've only seen the movie once, or maybe you're not that big a fan of it, I don't recall. They, Fuller and company, love to make visual and what they call oral homages to The Shining show. They've done it many times over these three seasons, which, you know, Shining is a favorite movie of mine, so I get a kick out of it. Because if you were to go back to the early scene, it might have been the first episode, one of the first ones, where there's a scene, I think, be with Jack and Will in the bathroom at the FBI. And if you were to go back and look at that scene, no, there's no bathroom in any U.S. federal building that would be like this. It looks exactly like the creepy, bizarre red bathroom from The Shining, because they just paint everything red, and it's just, and I read about it, like, we basically wanted to recreate the bathroom that Jack Torrance in The Shining, which is just a strange desire to do that, but anyway, I digress. I'll get back to the episode, I'm sorry. What was I talking about? Oh, he's having this panic attack, right? And he rushes to the attic, and, you know, he starts having his skull-splitting thing happening again when he's looking at the little painting or something. But it turns out that... Oh, I keep calling her Rita. Her name is Reba. I apologize. Reba had just gotten up, got dressed, and she was waiting in the living room. Because, hey, you know what? She's blind, so it probably would have been a little bit difficult for her to leave on her own. I mean, I guess she could have sort of maybe tried to call someone, but, you know, anyway. I really like her on the show, by the way. And that's saying something, because I hated her on the other show that I know her from, but I'm really liking her character on this. And, again, a very good, strong female character, which is nice to see on shows that we watch. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay.
I'm listening. You sure her name isn't Rita? I thought it was Rita Blackmore or something.
I think it's Reba, not Rita. I'm going to verify that right now. I apologize for taking up time on our little thing.
Yeah, no biggie.
I just want to make sure that... Reba McLean. Yes, it's Reba. Okay.
Oh, McLean.
So, I was wrong. Rita is the name of the character from Dexter, maybe?
Yeah, I know that. Come on.
I don't know.
Well, I guess it's okay to remember that, because that's when Dexter was actually good.
Yes, right. God, who would have thought that, even though I didn't really care for a character very much on Dexter, that the show would get so bad once she left it. Anyway, let's get away from the bad serial killer show. Let's get back to the good one. And speaking of really kind of cool female characters, although she may not have any more lines than she has in this episode, we're at the state hospital where Lecter is, and Denise... When she's going to bring in the phone for him, but basically, you know, she's like, you know, tells him, like, you know, stand over there or I'll mace you in the face. I was thinking, wow, she's kind of awesome. Who needs Barney, who is the character who used to be at the state hospital in the books, right, and the movies, but they haven't been able to get the rights to for some reason. I don't even understand that. But, also, I just to be a smartass, when she said the line about mace in the face, I started thinking, oh, so you used to be one of those people who used to deal with the Occupy Wall Street protesters a couple years ago. Okay, I got a little political. I apologize. So, but after getting the phone, Lecter, he uses what it looked like the wrapper from a stick of double mint gum or something, and he pulls a total MacGyver kind of a trick. By getting it within the putting it inside the phone receiver, he's able to call out, or at least get the operator on the phone. And he uses that to call Chilton's office. And he pretends to be Chilton's publisher, and he basically tricks the weekend secretary into presumably giving him Will Graham's address. Now, I'll admit, when this first happened, for a minute or two, I got confused. And I had to pause it, and I had to pull out the book, and I had to go read up on it. And it turned out I didn't even need to read the book, because all I had to do was just wait till after the commercial break, and then everything would have been clear to me. So, but to be clear, when he sent Will Graham that note originally, he had sent it to Will Graham in care of the FBI. He hadn't had his address at that point in time. Because we see in the very next scene, that's how he was able to send cards and stuff to Dr. Bloom, I guess. Is that who it was who says I've been getting greeting cards from him? Or Bedelia. Oh, it's Bedelia.
Yeah.
Bedelia is the person he sent the cards to. I'm sorry, I apologize. Anyway, just to be clear, that's why he's getting Will's address now. He did not have it before, so that note he sent to Will went directly to the FBI, which therefore is a better explanation of why Jack was able to so easily read it and let it go on to Will. I also, one last thing, then I'll get back to the episode. In the book, when Lecter does do this, he actually only gets a P.O. box for Will other than the FBI office location. So he actually doesn't get his address when he does this book. Anyway. Right. So then we go back to Will speaking with Bedelia. Was there anything really that interesting? Oh, I mentioned it's kind of like a little tennis match between them. They keep going back and forth. Will is like, he actually says to her, if he does end up eating you, Bedelia, you'll have it coming. Jeez. So they have this little back and forth because it's clear that Will kind of sort of wouldn't mind seeing Bedelia pay in some way for the crimes that were perpetrated a few years ago. I think he obviously thinks she does bear some responsibility, even if it's a small amount, which is funny because, quite frankly, so do you, Will. But I like he's accusing her of lying, and she just says, I obfuscate. She's pulling a Lecter on him, essentially. He also has a line here where they talk about doing no harm, and he asks her, did you? And she says, technically? And I remember thinking, oh, is she making a reference to when she pulled the knife out of the guy's head? And Lecter said to her, well, technically, you killed him. I'm pretty sure she is, which is a very dark little bit of humor there. Oh, and this is when we get the Zachary Quinto flashback, the full flashback that you were talking about before. I don't know if we ever get a name for his character. If we did, I certainly didn't. I didn't note it, didn't write it down. So
yeah, he's I said it, but I can't remember. I don't know. Well, maybe I'll think of it.
It's hopefully it's not really all that important because I think his entire involvement is just consigned to this scene anyway. But what we can figure out, and I think we kind of guessed this when we saw it the first time, he was a patient that got referred to her by Hannibal. So this is a flashback. And we can clearly see that he's paranoid, but I wonder if this is a case of, you know, sometimes being paranoid, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're not right. Because he says there's something wrong with Lecter, because ever since he's gone to see him, his condition has actually worsened. And he believes Lecter has done something to him. He does make a reference to that he nearly choked on his own tongue in front of him, and Lecter just remained indifferent. And I think any fan of Hannibal Lecter and the Silence of the Lambs will remember that Lecter convinced a fellow inmate, Miggs, who had thrown some of his ejaculate at Clarice Starling, to choke on his own tongue. He actually talked him into choking his own tongue. So you wonder if he had, this was him practicing way back when with Zachary Quinto. But they seem to be going back and forth between the flashback and Bedelia with Will. So Gillian Anderson gets to work double time here because we keep slipping back and forth between present day Bedelia and a few years ago Bedelia. So she has a lot of kind of fun stuff here. I like that she says to Will, is your wife aware of how intimately you and Hannibal know each other? And I was thinking, I don't even know if Will is aware of how intimately he and Hannibal know each other, quite frankly. But in the Zachary Quinto flashback, we see that he's getting more and more agitated, and he, to the point where he believes that Bedelia is conspiring with Hannibal, you know, even more so because she wants to prescribe the same medication for him. And I like that he says the phrase, this is culty and weird, which we could really say about the show at this point. And then he's choking again. And then we get the scene that when we saw it a few weeks, several weeks ago, was like really bizarre and surreal. And now it's still a little bit, but at least it makes a bit of sense. How do we describe what she does without using the obvious word, or maybe you just need to use it? Well, she's trying to clear his airway because he's choking, but she essentially fists him. clear down to it through his esophagus. And it's so bizarre. But at least now it's grounded in some sort of context, so I guess we understand it. I'm not sure if he dies by choking or he dies by what she ended up doing to him, or if it's a combination of the two. Because when she withdraws her entire arm, it's pretty bloody. Huh. I wasn't really sure. And when we toggle back to her and Will, really, you know, we'll cut through all the back and forth between them. The point of that whole conversation is that Will's empathy seems to do him more harm than good. And she's pretty much advising him that maybe next time he should be more inclined to hurt rather than help, because his help usually leaves him hurt. Okay, I might have gotten a little bit more weirdly cryptic than the show tends to get, but you know what I mean. So then we get to Will and Hannibal, and Will is showing him that carving on the tree. I guess he took pictures of it. I like how when he first shows him the carving, do you notice that Lecter doesn't initially seem to want to let on what he knows? Because the first explanation he gives, he knows full well it's wrong. That kind of reminded me of when he was supposed to be helping the FBI, but he kept misleading them all the time.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if he would even bother saying anything more about it if Will himself doesn't pretty much say, well, I also know that it translates to Red Dragon from like a Mahjong tile or something like that. So then Lecter, being Lecter, has to give Will an art lesson, because that's what he likes to do, about William Blake and that infamous painting, one that he refers to as radiating a unique nightmarish charge of demonic sexuality. So then we get this whole thing where I guess they're discussing how the families and the murders of the families have helped to transform and strengthen the dragon. And Will, you know, he's still struggling with what the common factor is that links the two families to this killer. Because it's the 21st century, and this isn't the 1980s, so families generally aren't having actual film process of their current home movies. So I'm still waiting to find out how they're going to figure that thing out on the show. But Lecter continues to chide Will a little bit, you know, even while he's trying to figure out that puzzler, telling him, you know, there's going to be more houses for that mind of killer trick that he does, because it's only 11 days till the next full moon. And that brings us to what I like to say, my corner of the USA, Brooklyn, or to be exact, the Brooklyn Museum. And we see Francis Dolarhyde. He's quite well dressed this time. Like I said, he's already been revealed to be far craftier than we had assumed before. And I think that was there earlier, so this would be more plausible now, I think. Because he's posing as a scholar in order to gain access to see the Great Red Dragon painting. Because it's not even currently on display at the museum, and he actually goes on a day that only researchers or art classes are allowed on the premises. Now, you might be wondering why I bothered to leave in that detail. I could have just skipped over that, but give me 20 seconds here. I'm only going to point that out because I want to fill you all in on how precocious and annoying I was as a child and how times have changed. When I was 8 years old, I actually took art classes on Saturdays at the Brooklyn Museum, and that was like several subway train rides away from where I used to live, but I was actually allowed to go there by myself. And this is 1978, so the New York subway system was just a little bit scarier than it has been, you know, in decades, quite frankly. So that's how much of an eye my parents, or my mother at the time, kept on me. But, you know, I was precocious. She figured, you know, I could talk my way out of getting mugged, I guess. I don't know. All right, back to the episode. I'm sorry. Just want to give a little personal insight. So he's led to this room, you know, it's kind of almost like a vault kind of room kind of thing, or archive. And when the museum director brings out the painting for him to see, she reminds him that he can look, but he better not touch. It's almost like he's about to orgasm right there on the spot. I mean, you know, I was like, is Ryuko on her knees over there? I don't know. Anyway, he then proceeds to knock out the one with a blackjack. I know that because that's what he uses in the book. And he obviously uses something to hit her back in the head with. I don't think he chloroforms her, though. And he does do that in the book. We see him, like, holding his hand over her nose to maybe that will help her sleep. I don't know. I'm not really clear on that, but who cares? So he's alone with the painting.
Yeah, and I didn't think, I thought, you know, here, I didn't think he was actually being, you know, smart here, just kind of like, you know, making, I mean, he has a pretty obvious, you know, physical disfigurement, so just doing that and, you know, kind of blowing his cover seemed like a not very kind of impulsive.
Oh, no, I don't think his act was smart. I thought, there's a lot of things that aren't smart about this, true. But just the idea that he would be able to pose as this thing, to go through all this trouble and be able to access the painting, because, you know, there has to be a bit more to that, because anyone could just walk and say, I'm so and so, and I would like to see the painting, please. Oh, you are? Okay, sure. And, you know, he had to be convincing, so that's fine. But I know what you're saying. I'm actually going to you're like 2 minutes away from me addressing something right around those. All right, I'm rambling. I got to get back to it. So he's sniffing and he's like almost inhaling the picture. And he eventually, he consumes the whole damn thing. You know, he's chomping through it like he's some ravenous beast or something. At first, I wasn't sure if he had any of his special teeth in, but I did rewind it back a couple times. I took a close look. It does look like he might have put the teeth in, because his teeth do look a little weird. This one moment where he opens his mouth wide to take one big bite, which would make sense because he does use those snaggle teeth all the time. It's part of his becoming the dragon. So here's the part where it moves away from the book. Because this scene does happen in the book, but it happens very late in the story. But what happens next does not happen in the book at all. Because thanks, I guess, to his little conversation with Lecter, Will shows up. He's also there to see the painting. Here's a question I had. Why is Will there to see the painting? Because here, if he just wants to see the painting, he could look at it online. He doesn't need to see it in person. He's not going to have one of his vision things by looking at the painting. There's been no evidence that it would trigger that. You know, that doesn't make any sense. I didn't get the impression that Lecter had clued him in that the killer was going to show up there. So I just kept wondering, why is Will going there at all? I don't understand it. But I don't care.
I kind of got the impression that it was kind of like, you know, like Seven, where he's just trying to like figure out, like, you know, who's interested in it, and maybe trying to use that as a, you know, a starting point. Some, you know, as to going down to see the actual painting itself probably would be unnecessary, because there'd probably be some kind of sign-in sheet upstairs or whatever. But
I guess it's you know what? Again, we said it several times during the season. I know maybe I need to move away a little bit from logic on this show at times, but now we're in a storyline that is a bit more grounded than what we saw the first half of the season. So it bothered me, but it didn't bother me much because I like that they did something different. So like what you just said, I can accept that. That's fine. Whatever. the fact that he had to travel so far just to look at a painting that he could, whatever, okay, I'll go along with it because it's fine. Because, anyway. We get two things that happen that didn't happen in the book in one episode that are encounters. Because early in the episode, we get a face-to-face between Dolaride and Lecter. You know, be it imagined or not, we still get to see it on screen. First time ever. And now we get to see these two encounter each other, which happens way sooner than it ever did in any film or book version. I actually thought they almost made a nod to the fact that in every previous version, Francis Dolaride is supposed to be a bodybuilder. By the way, he lifts Will Graham almost like a toy and then like flings him out of the elevator. It's a pretty cool little scene there. But now, getting to what you said a few moments ago, you kind of question the intelligence of this whole plan for Dolaride, because number one, well, Will has now seen your face. Number two, you're in a museum, which undoubtedly has cameras everywhere. So any number of cameras will have picked you up as well. So I have to think that his obsession with that painting and his transformation has overridden his intelligence and his scheming, quite frankly. Which, again, I'm okay with that. It just happened a lot earlier than I expected it to. But I guess they're really deciding to accelerate the storyline more than I thought they were going to.
Right. Yeah.
It
was very well done. That helps too. So even if they stretch the logic and split up the story, I mean, what they did was really effective. So.
Oh yeah, I'm willing to go along with it if it was A, entertaining, and B, will serve the story from this point on. It's clearly going to impact the story from this point on. This is not the opening minute of Star Trek Into Darkness. Couldn't resist, sorry. So that was the end of the episode. And I gotta say, for an episode that, you know, I think we might have sacrificed having Alana and Chilton in this one so we could have Bedelia, but I think we both wanted to see her again at least once. I was very pleased with this episode. Very pleased with it.
Yeah, they got a lot done in a good way, and never felt anything. They didn't waste any time, so it was pretty good.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the show, I would never accuse the show of super tight, fast storytelling, because that's not the nature of this series. But it goes to show you, when you have a definite story and a definite plot, and there's someone pursuing someone else, these are the episodes that you get. And that's what draws us in, and really why we love the first two seasons so much, and why I think we really like what's going on now, and why we had some problems with the first half of the season. I mean, these last two episodes, I mean, if I'm going back to the old letter grade thing, I probably would give them both an A-, because I think they've both been really swell adaptations, and they've just been really both fun and compelling for me. You know, I'm not giving anything an A+, because I think everything's always going to be a couple scenes where one's shy to get that, maybe that'll be achieved before the show is over. But, hey, I think every show we watch, every series we watch, there's only a couple A+ episodes. So,
yeah.
That's it. I really, like I said, I really enjoyed this one. Looking forward to what they're going to do next, because they make these little changes. I get kind of excited, because I feel like they're not just getting rid of stuff from the book. They're using it and they're adding on to it. Because it's a really, if you actually looked up that book, it's a very short book. It's not even 350 pages. It's a pretty taut book. So if Fuller and other co-writers like this guy Mancini or whoever else might work on the show, if they can flesh it out or fill it out a little bit more, because obviously they've got several episodes worth of time to fill, if they do that in a constructive way, and I know a lot of it's going to be giving Lecter more screen time, I'm sure. I'm okay with that. If, as long as we don't get into any lugubrious, needless silliness like they occasionally did in the first half of the season. You know, be it snails or or unexpected lesbian sequences, or you know, whatever else. But right now, I think the show is pretty much working on all cylinders, which makes me that much more angry that we still don't know if we're going to get anything beyond the season ever again.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. And just like, you know, I hardly ever watch episode previews for shows, but the last couple of weeks I've like, you know, when the episode ends, I kind of want to see what's, you know, what they're going to show for next. And then, of course, they don't bother doing it because NBC isn't promoting it anymore. So just like, oh, you know, they'll show scenes for some like just stupid looking show that we know is going to, you know, just completely suck. And then we don't get to see, you know, any little bits and pieces for the next one. So.
Yeah, it's ridiculous that. You know, I'm thinking the very same thing you are. I really want to see a little bit of next week, and really, you can't give me like 15 seconds. You can't even give us like the bizarre Mad Men style kind of little thing at the end. And I realize, yeah, it's NBC. They're the ones who bother cutting any kind of promotions for it, and they're just not going to bother anymore. They've relegated it to like the absolute last remaining time slot on their schedule, Saturday at 10. That would be considered like the lowest point in the entire schedule. So,
yeah. You know, I get that nobody's watched the show, you know, so I can't really blame them for canceling it. But then just, you know, you look at the previews for these new shows that they're like promoting for the next, you know, fall or whatever stuff's coming, and they just look so stupid. It's just like, ugh, NBC, yeah. You can't just air something nobody's going to watch instead of just this crap that everybody's going to just, you know.
Well, that's what NBC stands for, nothing but crap. So come on, they had to get rid of this. You know, I'm amazed they even have the blacklist still, because that's still at least decent, if not, you know, great. Yeah. Well,
only 3 weeks left, and I'm still holding out hope. And you know, it'd be nice if, we were talking about Dexter earlier. Maybe Showtime could pick it up, and then they could just have this nice poster. You know, they could just release this big graphic, just say, "We're sorry."
We're sorry.
Like Hannibal. It could be like Hannibal eating like a Cuban sandwich with like a little like scrap of like lumberjack cloth in it, and just be like, "Yeah, we're sorry. Hannibal season 4, 2016. Showtime."
Let me get this out of the way. Jinx, buy me a Coke. Both said we're sorry at the same time. I tweeted at Showtime several weeks ago saying I would forgive them for Dexter. I'd even pick up the subscription again if they didn't care. I said, you know, but get a million more people like you, and we'll think about it anyway.
But you know, just a stupid little thing like that marketing campaign would would literally just like, okay, you know, they did something stupid, they're gonna make it for it, and it would help, you know, erase the bad taste of Dexter a little bit, not that we're ever gonna watch it again. Or they could, as long as they didn't try crossing him over.
Anyway, the next episode will be called "And the Beast from the Sea." So this time I did remember to look up the title for the next episode. And hopefully we will get to do the podcast for that one, you know, within a day or two, and send it out to you guys, because I know you guys are always looking forward to our silly little podcast here. Should I wrap this up now? Because I think we might have a miracle happening if I do the wrap up really quick. So, if you enjoyed this podcast and would like to join the conversation about other TV shows that we watch, or movies, or any other crap we ever talk about, best place to do that is on Facebook. You can find us as the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. Just type in Serious TV Drama. You should be able to find us that way. You can like the page, join the page, and then join those conversations. The same goes for iTunes. If you just start typing Serious TV, chances are we'll be the first thing suggested. You can keep typing the rest of the title if you like, but either way, you can find us on iTunes that way. Subscribe to us there. And if you enjoyed this podcast as well as any others, feel free to rate and review us there. And yeah, that's about as quick as I've ever done that. So I'm ready to call it a night, because I see the finish line. I see a little sign saying you actually might get a podcast done in less than an hour.
Oh, I'm just laughing because Susan, who you just record a podcast with, listened to the podcast at a double speed. So I'm just imagining her listening to your plug there, double speed. How just, you know, it totally, you're gonna sound like a chipmunk there. So. All right, yeah, let's wrap it up. I think I'm going to go eat one of my Peanuts comics, and maybe I'll transform into a World War One flying ace.
Oh, that, you know what? It doesn't sound delicious. It sounds delightful.